Thank you for downloading the Sparkwood and 21 podcast. We are covering the television series Twin Peaks. This podcast is brought to you by No Ship Network. I am your host, Em.
And I'm your host, Steve. Spoiler warning, we are not a spoiler-free podcast. We like to spoil milk that's been left in the fridge for weeks on end. So if you have not seen the entire series of Twin Peaks, please go back and do so and then join us, because we would love to have you listen, but we hate to spoil anything for anybody. We just find it to be much more easy and interesting for listeners who've already seen the show to do it this way. You have been warned.
If you would like to support this podcast, go to iTunes, write us a review. You can also write us some feedback. The way to write us feedback is to go to our webpage at noship.net, and you'll see our contact page, and it will direct you to our Twitter, our Facebook, and our Gmail account.
We also have an Amazon link, which is a great way to support us. Just go to noship.net, click on the Amazon link. From there, it'll take you to the Amazon homepage, and you can do your shopping like usual. And it doesn't cost you an extra cent, but it gives us a tiny little kickback for things like Fi and Counter Esperanto.
Counter Esperanto.
Please, for the remainder of the podcast, for your safety and ours, stay on the bike. This week, we have a special treat in air quotes. Steve is going to be doing the recap. Steve, take it away.
Take it away, Steve.
We are covering Twin Peaks Season 2, Episode 16, titled On the Wings of Love. This one was written by Harley Payton and Robert Engels and directed by Dwayne Dunham. Any thoughts on this episode before we begin?
Why do you think it's called On the Wings of Love?
Because of the relationships that are starting up in this episode. I say relationships plural, but really it's just the relationship between Cooper and Annie, I think. And then the wings reference could be a reference to the owl, too.
And the fact that she's the one who pointed them to the owl cave.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that could be it as well. But I don't put too much significance onto the title of this one, because it really feels like a one that was kind of office made.
Yeah.
Like people are sitting around in an office going, okay, we got to get a good title for this one. Hey, On the Wings of Love. All right, done. Lunch break. Let's go. Because there's some titles for some of these episodes that really fit and sound kind of clever, like a lot of time and thought and effort was put into them. And then there's a couple of them that you're just kind of like, what? What are you talking about? So my thoughts on this episode before we get started basically boils down to two penguins walk into a bar. I like this episode. I thought it had there was some darker moments in it, but not very many. And it had it's permeated by a light feeling. You know, there's this light sense of coming out from something. And you could almost see it as them coming out from the muck and the mire of the really bad dragging parts of season two and on the upward trajectory towards the end, which everybody loves.
Yeah, you get that sense for a lot of different characters in here.
So one of our,
the exception of Donna.
Yeah. One of our listeners had pointed out that there was, in the last couple episodes, he felt that there was a springtime feeling going on.
That was Joel.
Joel, yeah. And I agree with Joel in this episode, especially. It feels like that, not necessarily weather-wise, but in the way that everybody's acting. So, but let's get into the recap and we'll discuss these things as they come up. We open the episode with a slowly creeping shot of the bookhouse in disarray. The guard is knocked out and bleeding. There's empty bottles, clothes strewn about, and a sleeping Harry who is being molested awake by Jones. She administers some perfume to his lips, and he thinks he is seeing Josie.
So you definitely think that's perfume? I was just wondering.
I'm assuming it's perfume because she has it in her garter, and it looks like a little perfume bottle. So I'm just making the assumption that that's what it is. But whatever, it could be a hallucinogenic. It could be.
And why would she put it on her own lips after if it's a hallucinogenic? Yeah. I was just wondering about it, and it doesn't mean it's either or. I think it is perfume. I think that's in the script, and it's probably Josie's perfume, maybe, Josie's scent.
That would make sense. That's why he wakes up, you know, because he's probably still half drunk anyway. Mm-hmm. So he wakes up thinking he sees Josie because he's smelling her scent, because they say scent is the strongest of our senses, right?
Like nostalgic.
As far as nostalgic is concerned, yeah. Like if you hear a song you haven't heard in a long time, it'll make you think of something. But if you smell a smell you haven't smelt in a long time, apparently it'll make you think of something even more.
That memory trigger is really powerful. Yeah, it's probably a perfume, but I was wondering if it was some sort of all, because she really throws herself into this this task, and she's on Kill Bill level of assassin, you know, dedication.
That's a good way to put it.
And she's like a succubus, in fact.
Yeah.
But I started thinking about the idea of the succubus, and I think Josie came into the night also into his bed, and I think I compared her to a cuckoo bird, but I think she was more like a succubus, because doesn't a succubus also like steal life force away from you and things
Yeah,
like that. And
it's
I think
draining that. Yeah.
Josie did that to Harry. But
Yeah.
anyway, that's a little bit off the point.
No, it's a good point, though. I mean, you could see Josie as being that. You could definitely see Jones as doing the same thing. And Jones then tries to strangle him with some deadly-looking wire.
That's called garroting, right? When you use that kind of wire?
Yeah, I think it is. Yeah, yeah. If she was able to, like, to actually complete it, because she would be cutting into the flesh. You wouldn't just be choking somebody. It's not like with a belt or
right.
rope or something like that. You'd be cutting into the skin and slicing the windpipe.
Yeah, severing
so
important parts.
But Harry, in fine form, lets her look for her teeth a couple of blocks up on Queer Street. The telegraphed punch. But it was more in a good context in this sense.
I'm glad it took a couple of punches for him to get her off. It wasn't, you know, because if she's able to get to the point where she can, we've already seen that she's pretty cool and collected when there's a gun pointed in her face.
Yeah.
And, you know, if garroting is her preferred method of assassination, she's got to have some pretty hefty cojones, you know. And for him to, it took him a couple of elbow, what do you call that when you're elbows
yeah,
to the
a back elbow or whatever. Yeah. Well, first of all, he pushes back and slams her bodily mm-hmm. against the wall, which that would jar most people loose a little
mm-hmm.
bit. Then he gives her two elbows to the stomach in a row. Then he hits her twice, and that's what finally takes her out. So,
yeah,
I mean,
she's tough.
She's a little bit of an intimidating character, so it's believable that it took all that.
Right.
And then he's about to hit her with some sort of, like, you know,
trophy.
Like it looked like a little minor league baseball
yeah.
trophy or something, you know, for T-ball. And he's about to whack her with that. And then he sees, I guess he just wakes up and sees that it's a woman, or maybe he sees that she's knocked out and he doesn't need to do anything further. But next scene is Jack and Audrey share a room service scene with some banter that turns sexual when he pretty much tells her that the next time she comes into his room, they're going to bang. And she leaves after they make plans for dinner and a flight on his private jet. And she says on the way out, if you bring a hammer, you better bring some nails, too. Well, well, well.
Yeah, especially when she said that, I felt like that was really sexual. I felt like he was saying to her, like, you know, no game plan. I need you just to be for real with me.
Mm-hmm. Or just be willing to follow through.
Yeah. So he's inventing something right there?
Well, they've kind of pitched his character as an inventor. That, or an innovator, at least. And he has some sort of contraption that just, it looked like, when the scene first comes in, I almost thought we were in like a high school cafeteria or something like that. And this is what the lunch ladies were cooking.
Or but Aunt Beru is making a milkshake.
with the blue milk.
Or her, not milkshake, but her food processor that she's putting like Napa cabbage in or something.
That's what that stuff did look like, Napa cabbage.
Yeah.
But we find a way to bring Star Wars
into
everything, don't we? But, yeah, I had no idea what it was, and they don't give you a hint as to what it was, and I don't think that whatever Jack is doing has anything to do with the storyline up until that point. I think it's just showing you that he's a tinkerer. He's one of those people who's always on the ball, constantly thinking about, you know, he's not really prone to distractions. The only distraction in his life is Audrey at this point, which is a welcome one, but he's a focused individual, so.
Well, they want to make this character, because since he's her counterpart or love interest, he also has to be smart.
Yeah.
And I feel like they're doing the she's all that kind of thing, because they put the glasses on him after, and it's like, okay, so he's supposed to be nerdy handsome. I get it.
And then when he takes the glasses off, the angels sing,
yeah.
and he's revealed as a hot guy.
Yeah.
Anything else to say about that scene?
No, that's it.
Meanwhile, back at the station, Truman tells Cooper that Jones will only speak to the South African consulate. And they kind of make a little comment about where the hell are you going to find a South African consulate in Twin Peaks, which is a great point.
Was Lethal Weapon, was this movie out around the same time? It's like, got diplomatic immunity.
Has just been revoked. I always feel, whenever I quote Lethal Weapon, I always feel like I'm on the set of Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
Oh, yeah.
But, Truman, in usual form, wonders blankly why Eckhart would want him killed. And Cooper points out that it's sexual jealousy, and he's kind of like, oh, yeah. So
that is a legit term. I looked it up real quick, and it's exactly what you would think it is. But
yeah.
It's like, is that an actual, like, what you can diagnose somebody with? And
it is?
Well, it's more of a description of human nature as far as jealousy in men, or in the the rationale behind it, or rationale is not the right word because it's more of an emotional thing, but for men, it's more of a fear of being cuckolded and raising a baby that's not theirs. And for women, it's the fear of losing the benefits that comes with a relationship. So men, it's more of a sexual infidelity, and for women, it's emotional. Like, emotional infidelity is worse for women.
That's what people have always said. And it, yeah. just being from a man's point of view, it's men, whatever they say, men are from Mars and women are from Venus, yeah. or whatever. It's really true in a sense, because when you, I don't want to get into a long diatribe or discussion about this, but I think there's some truth to that, because for a guy, it would be worse to find out that his partner has had sex with somebody else. And for a woman, it would be worse for her to find out that he loves somebody mm-hmm. else, you know, and I wouldn't want either situation to happen.
Yes.
You know what I mean? But I think I would be a little bit more okay if the person I was with was thinking about somebody else in a romantic way. I would still hate it to death, but I would be okay with it more than if I knew that they were actually having sex.
Yeah.
Huh. And it's you're like,
yeah,
you're
my face is all screwing up. Like, really? Yeah. That See, would be okay with you?
It's not okay, but if you had, it's one of those things. It's like a lesser of two evils. Yeah. If I had to pick which one of those yeah. to me would be the lesser of two evils, it would be that one. I would rather have the emotional relationship going on than the carnal relationship yeah. going on. And while women are the exact opposite,
yeah, it's
you
so
wouldn't
weird.
Want either scenario going on, but you would rather have your significant other, you know, just to have it be some sort of sexual fling than to be an emotional connection.
Yeah.
But that's just how, that's how we're built. So it's sexual jealousy. Cooper and Truman in a nice little funny scene discuss some disgusting hangover cures. Well, actually they don't discuss them. Cooper just lists them. And he goes through all these disgusting foods that Harry could eat, and it eventually has its desired effect, and he runs for the head to go throw up. But he mentions sweetbreads.
Yeah.
Yum. And if for the listeners out there who don't know what sweetbreads are, we're not talking about sticky buns and cinnamon rolls and muffins, but I knew what sweetbreads were from my culinary background, and I know that it's
okay.
Sweetbreads are the thymus, pancreas, and parotid glands of calves and lambs. The sweet comes from the sweet taste of the thymus, which is in, I guess, contrast to the savory taste of muscle tissue. And bread possibly comes from the word breed, B-R-E-D-E, which means roasted meat, or the Old English bread. I don't think it's pronounced like that, but that's how it's pronounced phonetically. That makes it sound like it's
bread,
maybe, which is flesh or meat. So when you hear sweetmeats or sweetbreads, rather, you're not getting what you think it's going to be. And that's what really sends Harry over the edge. Or is it the anchovies, do you think, that sends him over the edge? I'm not sure.
I don't know, but I bet cows have large parotid glands because they're always like chewing their cud. Because mm-hmm. parotid glands are the large salivary gland in your cheeks. That,
oh.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So they're probably, it's probably huge.
So Doc Hayward, Cooper, and Truman are congregating over a bonsai tree that apparently Josie sent Harry. So I guess we can believe this because it's only been a couple of days since she's been dead, and it could have just been going through the mail system.
But
so
obviously we'll just... it wasn't Josie, it was Wyndham Earl.
Right, but I'm saying, like, why would they not blink an eye at that? There has to be – I'm looking for the in-world explanation why a flower that shows – or
well,
a
yeah,
plant that shows up from a dead woman.
Especially in those
woman.
Days, mail was a little
right.
bit
Right, okay. That's slower. All I was getting at.
Yeah.
The good doctor lets Harry know that Wyndham Earl was at his house yesterday. The chess move is given just as Gordon Cole enters to give Cooper the classified dossier on Earl.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, you know, everybody knows that he's got a hangover. So Cooper's like, Harry, brace yourself. Close up to the bonsai and cut to Earl, who is listening through a hidden mic on the tree. This is where things get interesting, as we learn that Earl was on haloperidol to fake an illness rather than to treat it.
Mm-hmm.
And this was the same drug that Gerard was on. And that the Bureau lent out Earl to the Air Force in 1965 to participate in Project Blue Book about the UFOs and such. But there are 2 years that are scratched out and missing, and he can't be accounted for that. The obvious sausage links are made, and Cole shouts, Bonsai, into the tree, giving me the first laugh-out-loud moment of the episode.
Earl deserved that.
He did. And, you know, this kind of humor, it worked. And it hurt at the same time, because it works when Gordon Cole is in the room and he's doing all the things that you want Gordon Cole to do with his exuberant personality. But then you've got Wyndham Earl, and you're decreasing him yet another peg down the rung as a formidable villain type, because he's sitting there getting yelled at in an earpiece and then taking it out and cleaning out his ear, you know?
Yeah, he seems more...
Not to be taken seriously as an arch villain.
He's like diabolical in a comical way.
Yeah, I can, and then Leo's burping right there next to him, and he kind of looks at him, and he's just like,
So is haloperidol the gateway drug to the lodge?
That's a good question. I mean, if you can't get to the lodge through the other means of egress, whatever they might be, haloperidol might be the thing that does it. You know, it kind of puts you into this altered state where you could do that.
I mean, it's not that there's really any type of...
There is a link, really. I think you were about to say that there's not that there's any.
Well, it's just Mike, but Mike uses it, or Philip Gerard uses it to suppress Mike, where Wyndham Earls looks like he's going to get to the lodge through a physical way, not through a chemical way. Mm-hmm. So, but I don't know if he's had any dealings with, you know what I mean? I don't know.
He's been there yet. All I know is that when it comes to drugs, if you take a drug for, you know, something that you need it for, and the drug is doing what it's supposed to do, you feel a certain way. If you don't need that drug and you take it, you get a completely different experience off of it for the most part. Sometimes you don't get anything, but sometimes you'll get like whatever high you're going to get. You know, that's why recreational drugs are so tricky, because people are taking them for something that they don't actually have symptoms for, and then they're enjoying side effects that were never intended to be there. And you don't really have a lot of those side effects if you need the drug.
One of the lesser side effects is that men grow breasts.
On haloperidol?
Mm-hmm. So that would have been an interesting costume change for him.
That would have been an interesting costume change.
And maybe that's why he was missing for 2 years.
Yeah. Gender reassignment surgery. He had to become a man again.
Yeah.
This is probably my favorite scene of the episode. Cole then reinstates Cooper into the FBI and gives him a shiny new Smith & Wesson 10mm Model 1076 all stainless steel. And they share their moment, pursue, capture, and incarcerate. I like that a lot.
So is stainless steel like the best metal for guns?
I don't know. I mean, I own weapons, but I'm not a gun aficionado, so I don't really know. But I think stainless steel is probably pretty badass to have as a gun. I mean, because most of the weapons that I have are not stainless steel. And there's a tendency towards rust, and stainless steel is very rust resistant. You don't want to say anything's rust proof, but it's definitely rust resistant.
It cleans well.
Yeah. So, next scene. Earl has Leo pick 3 cards from the deck. And they are all queens with the faces of Audrey, Donna, and Shelley taped on them. Then he picks a card from behind Leo's ear, and this one is a king with Cooper's face. Earl explains that the winner of the Twin Peaks pageant will be the 4th queen and will be killed, in addition to getting a scholarship and $2,000. And Cooper gets to watch. Leo focuses on Shelley's face, and the wheels begin to turn.
Real quickly, I'm just going to point out, because there's 4 different kings he could have picked, and he chose King of Spades to put Cooper's face on. So I just thought I'd look up the attributes of that.
Mm-hmm.
So, meaning, an intelligent man in position of trust and authority, he is wise and loyal advisor, logical and calm, he dislikes overt displays of emotion. I'm not sure if that's true, but he requires a lot of mental stimulation. The reverse meaning, a distrustful, suspicious person, one who intrigues and plays mind games, a double dealer or con man. And that would be Earl. So it'd be interesting because he's his opposite. So that's the reason why I chose that particular explanation.
That sounds good. I mean, if it checks off all the boxes,
mm-hmm.
I mean, it's nice to find little nuggets of insight in an otherwise pretty straightforward episode.
Mm-hmm.
So I like that.
It's just fun, too.
It would be the opposite. So what do you think about Leo looking at Shelley? It's like, I feel like there's a spark coming in there.
Definitely.
You know, they focus in. And I mean, we know what's going to happen. So, I approached that last paragraph as if, you know, we're doing the podcast for newbies or something. Like, what do you think's going to happen with that? We know what's going to happen with that. But it's just nice to see the genesis of it. Donna follows her mother into the Great Northern and sees her meet with Ben. So there are cars, I guess, that... people who are in wheelchairs, handicapped people, can drive.
Yeah, in fact, my dad had one, I think when my parents were first dating, and all the controls were up on the dash.
Really?
Yep.
Okay, so you could just do everything with your hand. I guess I think I knew that already. I just wasn't aware of it. But when I first saw the scene, I'm thinking, did like Donna drive her here? And then she said, just wait out in the car. And now she's going to go snoop and see what's going on. But you learn later on in the scene that she got there on her own. But so Donna follows her mother into the Great Northern and sees her meet with Ben. Mike and Nadine are checking out after their deep sea fishing expedition. Donna asks after Audrey and says an awkward hello to Mike and Nadine, and then voices her concerns over her mother seeing Ben Horn so much lately. Audrey decides it's time to spy.
Mm-hmm.
So we finally get back to the spying peephole. A little bit too late, though, because what they see
They
is,
miss a whole lot of
yeah,
information.
they miss like the most important part of it.
Right.
But, you know, that's how it's going to work.
But, there's enough said and gesture that you could really, with him holding onto her hair like that, they
Yeah.
see that. I mean, nobody's,
That's an intimate thing
it's
that.
way intimate.
Inside the office, Ben and Eileen discuss secrets from the past. She wants him to take back a stack of letters that he wrote to her. Ben insists he's trying to be good and make amends, but she would rather things stay the way they are. He gets creepy and she has to yell to get him off her. Come on, Ben, she's in a wheelchair.
He gets, I guess you can call it getting creepy, but obviously they've had a love affair that was quite passionate in the past, and she remembers it fondly because when he first starts to, touch her and everything, she gets a smile on her face, but then her better, like, control, she stops and she's like, "All right, get off me now."
Yeah, well, you know, he says, "I haven't touched you since that night," meaning the night that they conceived Donna. So, you know, to if she's 18, you're trying to like pick up in the afternoon, one random afternoon, you know, in the spring, what happened 18 years ago. I mean, this is a lifetime. You know what I mean? She's married, she's raising a child, three children. But anyway, Audrey and Donna get to the peephole late, but still hear an intriguing exchange. Donna is going to find out what's up. So, you know, what Donna's doing right now doesn't have anything to do with the Laura Palmer plot. Nothing at this point has anything to do with the Laura Palmer plot. The only thing that has even the most tenuous link back to Laura is what Ben Horn says about by way of apology to Audrey later on in the episode. And there's a little bit with the petroglyph, I think, but we'll get to that later.
The ring.
Yeah, in the fire. At the Double R, Cole discusses his own hangover remedies that has Harry speeding towards the loo again. The raw meat with the egg and the anchovies and Worcestershire, that would make you puke if you
There's got
were.
to be a bureau inside joke or something,
Yeah,
'cause
yeah. I guess there's a lot of hard drinkers at the FBI. Cooper looks dapper back in his FBI getup, I think. And Cole notices Shelley.
Finally.
This is one of the sweetest scenes in the whole series to me, as we see Gordon Cole can hear Shelley Johnson just fine without the hearing aid. He needs massive amounts of pie and a glass of water because his socks are on fire.
Counter Esperanto.
Yeah, he goes to engage in a bit of counter Esperanto. So we've had a discussion previous to starting the podcast on what we thought this might mean. And what did you come up with?
Well, first, let me just give the definition of Esperanto. It is a constructed international auxiliary language. It is the most widely spoken constructed language in the world, and it was meant to be an easy-to-learn, politically neutral language that would transcend nationality and foster peace and international understanding between people with different languages. So we had a discussion because we were talking about, well, he says counter
Right.
Esperanto. So would it be the opposite? So he's being almost deprecating, like, I'm going to go up and try to talk to this girl, but I know it's not going to be successful. But it's because he's going up to an actual counter.
I
Because
think
so he
that's
did
it.
have hope for it.
At first, I was agreeing with our first assertion, but then when you said, well, it could be counter, as in the actual Formica table. But not that that table's Formica, but I think the second one is probably true. I think Gordon Cole's being a little bit clever here, and he's going to say, I'm going to go engage in some counter Esperanza.
Esperanto.
I like that.
Yeah, me
We'll
too.
stick with that. But this is really one of the sweetest scenes in the whole series to me, because, you know, she acts so well and he's there, and there's a nervousness that she has to portray as somebody who's trying to get this guy to quiet down and, you know,
Well,
just
he's giving her compliments, so that's already embarrassing. And then they're
right.
projected to the whole dining room. It's like, all right.
Yeah. But also, I think there's a little bit of reality to it, too, because Daddy's back. This is the creator of the show. You know, well, him and Mark Frost. I'm not trying to give Frost short shrift, but this is the man, you know, this is David Lynch, and he's back in a season two episode with a significant part. And
And he's back for 2016 Twin Peaks.
yes, thank God. The spirits in the lodge are smiling favorably on us for next year. So I'm thinking that, you know, Machen Amick is actually displaying a little bit of honest nervousness about this, because she's, I mean, I'm not taking away from her acting chops, but she's probably like, this is the guy who hired me. This is the creator of the show,
Maybe.
you know, so it's a scene with him. So it just plays really well to me. I thought it was, and I think David Lynch probably has a crush on her in real life too. So
It seems like that, but I don't want to say that for sure.
I don't think it's a,
I think it's a an innocent
it
like
is. Yeah. It's like that. I don't think it's a creepy old man thing. I think it's like
no.
an an innocent thing, but it's still there. So anyway, Cooper is drawing symbols on a napkin when Harry returns from the bathroom, and they discuss whether or not it's a finch or a chickadee on a Dodge Dart parked outside. Annie comes over to confirm it is a chickadee. She and Cooper have a bit of flirting, and Harry flips the script with Coop's old question of how long have you been in love with her?
Mm-hmm.
Who says anything about love? Insert penguin joke here. The design he was drawing is a combination of Briggs' tattoo and the log ladies, and Annie recognizes it from the markings at Owl Cave. Truman confirms this, and a field trip plan is hatched. So, social awkwardness aside, do you think her acting's getting, you know, any better? Or I thought it was appropriate for the scene.
Yeah, it's good enough.
For my part in it, I'll say this. I'm not going to sit here and say that she's a horrible actress or anything like that, because I don't think that's the case. I think that she's trying to her best to convey in a awkward and stiff fashion how it would be for a person to come out of a convent and go back into reality.
I think she still has sea legs or something like that. So
yeah. So next up, Donna gets James' emo postcard from San Francisco with the Just You and I music playing in the background, thankfully sans vocals, and then confronts her dad about her mother's relationship with Ben Horn. He is evasive, but now we know that he does know something, so that gives us a clue into what's real and what isn't.
Yeah, because he was not trying to be a convincing liar.
At all. Oh, that's exactly what's going on. She told me at breakfast.
I'm sure it was that.
Yeah. You know what it reminded me of? It reminded me of Leland Palmer in Fire Walk With Me. Whenever she's asking him, did you come home that day? And he's like, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I did, actually.
Right.
It's that same kind of lying, like, all of a sudden I remember this fact that I didn't know 2 seconds ago.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it's either here nor there, if it's just a coincidence. But, as Cooper says about coincidences, flowers arrive for Eileen with no card. And Donna gives her dad a knowing look as she goes to put them in water.
She's like, served.
Yep.
I want to say, Donna's hair is awesome this episode, and I like that shirt she's wearing in that scene.
Yeah, she's pretty sharp and snazzy. She's
she's looking nice.
I wish they had a bigger role for her, but you know. Anyway, next up, Audrey is at the library doing research on civil disobedience, possibly for a high school assignment.
I think it's because her dad's embarking in civil disobedience with the pine weasel.
Yeah, you're probably right. I guess I'm just hoping here that, you know, like, is she going to be the first person to, like, own and run the Great Northern who probably had to go get a GED? Anyway,
maybe.
This is just my personal pet thing that I keep coming back to, the kids in high school.
Yeah,
I don't know.
They want you to know that, yes, Audrey is beautiful, but she's also intelligent. She frequents libraries, and people have to, as a descriptor, have to drop the word intelligent, but she's not finishing high school. Mixed message there. Just mixed message for the kiddos.
Yeah, because Jack says that, you know, she's an intelligent, beautiful young woman.
Mm-hmm.
And she runs into Edward Perkins' incarnation of Wyndham Earle. She asks him for his help identifying a poem someone sent her. He has her read it aloud, and when she is done, he says it was Shelley. And she looks taken aback. She's like, wait, what?
Yeah,
but she doesn't know who the poet Shelley is. So she's just like, why would you say that? You know, so there might be little dots connecting in her head. Not recognizing the name as poet, she... Oh, okay, I already read that, so just scratch that. So, anything else you wanted to say about that scene?
Yeah, but her creep alarm went off.
Yeah, it did.
And it didn't stop going off, even after he was like, the poet Shelley, which I think he's referring to Percy Bysshe Shelley, but, you know, it was still...
And when that...
She's like, that didn't make it better.
Since when the hell do you get to smoke in a library?
Yeah, and the smoke is just, like, puffing into her face.
It's continue, like, you never see him inhale. It's just coming right out of the pipe at this steady rate. Speaking of Shelley, back at the Double R, Shelley and Annie talk about life in the convent, and Annie asks what she knows about Cooper. The only other thing I had on this scene was that Shelley kind of has a knowing smile when she says, I don't want to have anything to do with that guy. I was just asking. And she's just like, yeah, right.
I thought about this scene later on because Shelley's trying to make conversation with her, and she says, you know, stuff about being out in the world and seeing things, and Annie gets kind of snappy about it. She's like, yeah, everybody says that, but it's not really like that.
Yeah, we have cable TV.
Yeah, it's not like I haven't seen it. But when she talks to Cooper later, who kind of brings up the same subject, she's all warm about it and like, yeah, it is like that. I'm still trying to get used to things. Yeah.
It's I guess it's a gender thing. I mean, you know, if it's a woman that she feels like she could be in possible competition with, then, you know, her answers and responses are going to be a little bit different when it's
She's a little catty.
Yeah, she is. She does get snippy with her a bit. But, you know, she brings it back around and, you know, she starts talking about Cooper as a way.
After she finds out Shelley's not interested in Cooper.
Yeah.
That's why.
Oh, there you go.
That was her way of, like, tell me what you know about this Cooper. She was finding out.
So anyway, at the station, we get a surreal scene with Andy practicing his spelunking in front of Lucy, kind of coming down from the roof all the way down to the floor.
It's really goofy, but I like how they make use of her window there with Andy. There's been many, not pratfalls, but what is the word for, like, comical...
Like slapstick stuff?
There's just been many comical moments, it seems like, in front of that window with Andy.
Yeah.
And this one was funny. It's stupid, but yeah. It's funny.
I searched in vain for some sort of insight that I could pull from the fact that she's sitting here playing chess and watching him practice his spelunking right in front of her. It's almost like he's trying to show off his manhood because she is impressed by the gear, you know, and she makes him promise to be safe. And she's like, I know you're going to be strong and I know you're going to be brave, but you have to promise me to be safe. And she's not too happy with Dick at this point after the pine weasel fiasco from the night before. So Cooper and Truman get ready to go to the cave and discuss the latest chess move, and the directors make sure that there's a shot of the bonsai tree there to let you know that Earl has heard these plans as well and will probably be showing up at said cave.
Mm-hmm.
Johnny Horn is hunting the many-colored buffalo of the waterfall as Ben looks on. He asks Audrey to be his right-hand man like Bobby Kennedy was to JFK. He then confesses that he was not the world's best father, but wants to make amends and build a future for the family, and he wants her to help.
And when he says, like, you're the only man for the job or something like that, that's, you hear Johnny again in the background, like, ah!
Yeah.
So you know, well, it obviously.
Right. I have two children that I could bequeath this to, but anyway. Okay, so, you know, he kind of wants to get across the message that this family business is going to go to her and not him.
Right.
So, I thought it was significant too that he says, I want to build a better future for this family, for you and for me, and or something to that effect. But he leaves out Johnny and he leaves out the mom.
Sylvia, yeah.
Yeah, they're just like non-entities, you know. It's they're really the family because, you know, Jerry's not even around at this point. Or I don't know if he's gone from the series completely. If we get another scene with him in, I can't remember. But he's not here in this episode at least. She agrees to this and is immediately sent off to Seattle on pine weasel business, thereby missing her date with Jack, who just entered the room. Jack and Ben share carrots and ruminate about truth and the fact that Jack is falling in love with Audrey, with the soundtrack of Johnny the Hunter playing outside. So what do you think of this scene? The carrots and the couch
taking
talk.
Taking the shoes off and sitting cross-legged. I'm not sure if I really had a lot of thoughts just outside of just watching the scene.
I feel like the writers really wanted to use the character of Ben Horn. They didn't want to leave him by the wayside, but he has less and less to do with the plot points that are going forward because they're getting towards the end of the series and the Black Lodge stuff and everything.
Right.
And he doesn't have too much to do with that. So I felt like this story arc after the Civil War in his head of him becoming good and trying to make amends for all of the bad shit that he's done in the past was what they could come up with. And there's some stuff in feedback that we're going to read that kind of lends me or has me lend a more sympathetic feeling towards Peyton and Engels than I've had previously.
Hmm.
But that's all I really had to say with that. It's not really going anywhere too much, just that this is what we're getting out of Ben Horn. He's eating carrots and celery, and he's worried about the pine weasel and the nature of goodness and the truth.
I wonder if he has more empathy for his son now because he just had to go through this whole thing where he had to work through emotional problems through Civil War reenactment where his son has his own emotional problems and he's, you know, playing at being a Native American.
Hmm.
Some sort of familial trait. He got to work through things theatrically.
Yeah, because he doesn't seem derisive of him or annoyed by him like he might have been in the past.
Mm-hmm.
He just seems very tolerant of him, even when he's like yelling outside when he's trying to have a serious conversation with somebody. The entire police department decides it's a good idea to go spelunking in the Owl Cave at night.
Mm-hmm. And Harry's surprised to find beer bottles.
Yeah, Hawk tells of how they used to play in the caves as a kid and pretended that they were haunted by spirits. Beer drinkers, by the look of them, Harry says. Yeah, that's about the extent of his police work in the last five episodes.
In the last 5 years.
Yeah, he picks up a can of beer and he's like, beer drinkers. Really? They could have been beer spillers. You don't know that, Harry.
Well, the fact that he's surprised by it, of course, that's where teenagers are going to go and do stuff like that.
Yeah.
It's duh. And every cop should know that. I mean, every parent probably knows that.
Well, they find the symbol that Cooper was drawing, two symbols combined into a larger whole. The party is harassed by an owl that is shrieking like a human, and Andy takes a swing at it with his pick, and it gets stuck in the stone. It loosens one of the shapes, one of the diamond shapes, and an Indiana Jones-type wall movement takes place, revealing a petroglyph.
So you thought Indiana Jones, I thought Goonies. Remind me of Goonies, too.
Yeah, yeah. Like, whenever all the stuff, like, and you see the skeletons and everything.
Yeah, and then the piano, and there's just a lot of...
So anyway. The petroglyph, to me, looks like a ring in fire. It's a little symbol on mm-hmm. the end of the pole.
It looks like an owl in flight, like from the
okay.
like with the way we saw after Leland died. And I was trying to think of the inverted, what it's supposed to look like, the inverted, if that was supposed to represent something. And
so what is a petroglyph? Did you look that up?
Petroglyph is a rock carving, and it's where you remove the well-worn patina off of stone, and you reveal a lighter color underneath. And so that's how you create the image. And there are some that out there that people claim are UFO related, but it's not any legitimate work
yeah.
producing that information. And when you look at some of the images that people claim are UFOs, you're like, oh, I don't know about that. You're really reaching. You really want this to be.
Whenever I think about UFOs, and I believe in their existence, just because I can't see an infinite universe out there with us mm-hmm. being the only speck of anything significant in it. That's just narcissistic in the extreme and just highly improbable. But whenever I think of UFOs and I think of the rudimentary stuff that gets left behind on Earth, and it's like, if you've got a society that could build something to reach us from across the interstellar gulfs, they'd leave something better than that, you know?
Yeah, they wouldn't
scribble.
They wouldn't be scribbling. It's us scribbling images of them visiting.
All right, I get you. Unless they let their kids off the ship and go write something on the wall, you know, and then come back.
Go try to communicate for us.
Yeah. Andy goes to the bar in the Great Northern and is served by the captain from Rescue Me, who... Cooper enters the same bar dictating the day's adventures to Diane when he sees Annie alone at the bar. Cooper and Annie talk in metaphors about starting a relationship with one another. At least that's how I took it, because he was offering his help, and she was saying, well, I can't always promise I'm going to be this way or that way. And ostensibly, it was about one friend offering help to another and how this is going to go. But really, I thought it was a metaphor for them beginning a relationship
yeah.
with each other. And
yeah.
she was saying, don't expect a lot from me because I'm not like other people. And he's kind of saying, I know how you feel. So I thought that was another sweet moment. And it's going along with the theme of this episode. It was very stiff and weird on one hand, but fitting to their characters on the other. That's not a normal courting process.
No. Yeah. And it's presumptuous in a way, too. You know, I feel like they've just met and they're really jumping the gun.
Well, it's almost
Annie
like they
got a gun. So dumb.
Annie's got a gun. I'm looking at it as like two people who they know they're drawn to each other. So they know this is kind of like an inevitability.
Mm-hmm.
And they're trying to lay out the ground rules for it, you know, before they begin. Which is it's a very unromantic way to do something.
Yeah, it's procedural.
Yeah, it's very procedural. It's a good word. But at the same time, like I said, it's fitting for their characters mm-hmm. because she needs that and he kind of craves that sort of order. So maybe they're just right for each other in that sense. The episode ends with Earl visiting the owl cave and finding the petroglyph with the symbol inverted on the ceiling because he does a little bit more police work than the police. So he turns the shaft counterclockwise until the symbol does invert, and then the rock wall starts to collapse at the end of episode. Very, very,
low budget.
Very low budget in chintzy. It looked like somebody had a plyboard wall with some rock stuff on it, and they just started pushing it from the other side, which I'm pretty sure is exactly what happened.
Yeah, that's what it looks like.
Once again, we're a victim of the nobody's going to look at this too closely, you know.
Well, I mean, it's just probably all they could. I mean, they had a low budget. I mean, there's right. Sometimes you just limited at what you're able to create, and especially with technology at that time too. So, there may have been the thought, well, nobody's going to really go back and re-examine this, or it might be like, this is all we can afford to do with the technology that's available.
Yeah. It just seems to me like you could have done something better if you didn't have a lot of money. You could have just had some rocks and scree falling over it to give the impression that something was going on behind it rather than shaking it like that. 'Cause rock's not really going to shake like that. It's either going to break loose or it's going to stay put.
I think they did have some things tumbling down in front of it, and
But
there
I'm saying
was.
that's all they should have done. They shouldn't have added
Oh, okay.
the other stuff in because then it you know, it's the end of the episode anyway, but if it was in the middle of the episode, it would just, you'd be thinking about that for the rest of the episode, you know, pulled out of your suspension of
That's true.
disbelief.
Yeah. So we were.
That's why I, you know, that's why you come down on stuff like that or get critical of it, not because you want to take the artistic department to task necessarily, but because the whole point of any kind of artistic endeavor when it comes to a television show is to keep your suspension of belief for that whole hour or, you know, whatever long period of time. And if they pull you out of it because of something that could have been avoided, they're not doing their job right. But that's the end of episode.
So, any other thoughts before we go into feedback?
Nope, I think we covered it all. It's a decent episode that had some good moments in it, and it's promising for the future.
Okay, so we have the usual three, the usual trio writing in. We also have a new person writing in, and we'll get to his here soon. I'm just going to read it in the order of how we received them.
Sounds good.
And then when we get, before we read Tyler's, I want to read something that Daniel had wrote on Facebook because Tyler also comments on the Ghostwood discussion we had last episode, and Daniel had wrote some more on
Yeah.
Facebook. So I'm just going to reserve that for at that time so they coincide. All right, first up, Joel. Hey, Stephen M. Last time I mentioned liking episode 24 more than anything else post-murder. Let me clarify. It still is not a very good episode, especially once it gets to that final 15 minutes or so. However, episodes 17 through 23 are so bad that episode 24 shines in comparison. So I'm not saying it's great, just that relative to all the Evelyn or Evelyn Marsh, because of Penny Dreadful, I'm saying Evelyn. Relative to all the Evelyn Marsh, Little Nicky slash Mayor, and his brother shenanigans of that 7-episode stretch, it's like a breath of fresh air. Fortunately, this week we get an episode that actually is pretty good, or should I say, damn fine. The primary reason is clear enough, and let me take this opportunity to say how appropriate it is that you are recording the episode in which Lynch returns to ABC's Twin Peaks in the same week that Lynch returns to Showtime's Twin Peaks. Yes.
This is not a coincidence.
It is a coincidence, actually, but as Cooper says, dot, dot, dot. Even though he didn't direct this episode or receive credit for the screenplay, I suspect he did some ghostwriting to ensure that Gordon Cole gets cozy with Shelley and the waitress.
See?
The show's spirits really lift when David Lynch enters the room, and thank God, Cooper finally gets back into the suit. Yes. The magic has returned for that scene in the diner, which is probably the most fun Twin Peaks has ever been. Here's where the late portion of season two really hits its stride. Other stuff in the episode is not quite so successful, but I find most of it, including Owl Cave, fun in a cheesy kind of way. As with the previous episode, this isn't up to the standards of season one, but it's genuinely enjoyable, and that's something. I wanted to offer a few responses to your previous podcast. First off, there's one show Brenda Strong was on that M didn't mention, and it was an interesting Twin Peaks connection, Desperate Housewives. Whoa. I didn't know there was a connection. I can't remember if someone mentioned this on a previous episode, but she actually replaced Cheryl Lee as the dead narrator of the series. Lee was cast in the pilot, but when ABC picked up the show, they decided her voice was too ethereal and wanted someone down to earth. I didn't watch the show, and I'm sure Strong was good, but it's a pity that they didn't stick with Cheryl Lee. Would have been interesting for her to play another dead woman on a show about small town secrets that also starred Kyle MacLachlan. Yeah, I might have been Daniel who wrote about Brenda Strong. I do recall that now. Okay, so regarding the Ghostwood debate. I didn't realize Joel wrote about that too. Okay. Regarding the Ghostwood debate, I think Steve may be right when it comes to the second season. The writers probably didn't realize the irony of having Ben's good gesture preserve a dangerous supernatural portal in the woods. However, since Ghostwood is first mentioned in the pilot, meaning Lynch and Frost came up with it, I suspect that there was always a self-consciousness to the name. Also, in the finale, Cooper emphasizes the words Ghostwood as if realizing that this place will provide the path to the Black Lodge. On the chess game, I thought Steve would enjoy this article I discovered on an old Twin Peaks message board. From the San Francisco Chronicle Personals column, Thursday, June 13th, typed in without permission. The show is over, but the remorse lingers on. Harley Payton, writer and producer of Twin Peaks, has expressed his regrets about the chess match between Dale Cooper and Wyndham Earle, which began last January at the behest of chess player and series co-creator Mark Frost. Frost quickly lost interest in the game. Payton told the Village Voice, and the rest of the writers plotted the moves with sporadic advice from the self-ordained chess experts on the set. Those are in quotations, by the way. Chess maven Helmer Pelaez told The Voice the game was pretty dumb, and Nick Conticello said it had no objective chess value and was hopelessly boring. Payton said he was sorry. We weren't as exact as we should have been, he said. It became a pain in the ass. So any comments on that before I move on to the rest of his letter?
Well, there's going to be more on the Ghostwood because we've got three different people writing, and I actually have some theories and ideas, and I realized that we gave it a little bit short shrift. Even though we talked about it for 5 minutes, I still think we didn't really come up with anything of substance to say about Ghostwood, and I actually have something that has to do with Ben and Ghostwood. It's a theory. But as far as the chess is concerned, I'm glad to see that there's other people who notice that too, and that there was something that actually addressed the fact that this was bunk. You know, because I feel like I was just nitpicking, and now I feel vindicated in the fact that I'm not just being a jerk and going, oh, it doesn't really work like that, blah, 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 blah. You know, other people did it. But I have to say that I'm disappointed in Frost because he liked chess enough to want it to be on the show, but then he got bored with it and didn't follow through. Is that what you said?
Yeah, Frost quickly lost interest in the game, Payton told the Village Voice, and the rest of the writers plotted the moves with sporadic advice.
So that's just irresponsible writing to me. I mean, you like chess enough to introduce it into this show that you're working on, but you don't have enough follow-through, and it really wouldn't have been that difficult to find a game. I mean, there's literally thousands of games out there that are annotated that you could go and look at and
imitate.
See and imitate. And even if you change just a little move here or there, you could make it look like an enticing game. Just give us a few screenshots every now and then of what's going on in the game, and it could look real. It could look plausible. And the fact that they didn't do that just disappoints me because I'm a chess fan and I'm a chess player and stuff, and I was expecting better. And the first time around that I watched the whole series, I didn't pay too much attention to it. But this time, you know, we were even going to set up a board. And, you know, our initial plan was to follow the chess game as it went. But then I started to realize that something, you know, is rotten in Denmark with this, and it wasn't adding up. So I'm just glad that, you know, thank you, Joel, for letting me know that I'm not, you know, just this like lone asshole thinking bad shit about these guys.
He goes on to say, next week, the final nail will be placed in this pawn-shaped coffin with the appearance of certain heavy metal dude.
I'm going to have to try to pick that person out because I don't remember from first view who this heavy metal person was. But hopefully I can tell who it is before the credits give it away.
And finally, a question for you guys. How do you feel about the mysterious aura of Twin Peaks getting codified in something as specific as the Owl Cave? I've heard people criticize this turn as to explicit lore as being too on the nose and literal. I can see that, and I'm glad Lynch makes everything more abstract and unexplainable in his direction of the finale. However, I'm so relieved that the show is finally reviving any mythology at this point that I can't really complain. Sincerely, a listener, both wonderful and strange, Joel.
What do you think?
Well, I it adds a bit of history to me. Or it puts it in place and time, and I don't mind it because it feels like it has this historical trajectory. If you've got a cave that's called Owl Cave, it's probably been called that for centuries or
long time.
A long time, at least.
Yeah.
Decades at the very least. And that's what I take from it. I don't really get too annoyed with it. I am, you know.
I'm not bothered by it too much. I do feel that I agree with Joel for the most part that I like the more abstract Lynchian elements of lodge mythology, but having this as an anchor of a physical time and place,
which you kind of need
for the characters to interface with, it serves its purpose as like a story. What do you call it? A plot device. It serves its purpose in that sense,
and it coincides with the Bookhouse Boys have been around for a long time. They're aware of something out there that they're protecting Twin Peaks from.
Yeah.
So it's almost like that's the source or the counterpoint.
Yeah, like you can polarize it into two camps, the Bookhouse Boys over here and the Owl Cave over here.
And whatever it's associated with.
So those are the physical manifestations of two powers that are opposed to each other. And then you have the more insidious, mysterious, intangible elements that kind of seep in here and there in the cracks.
I mean, is it the best way they could represent it? Probably not.
No.
But I'm okay with it.
Yeah, it's what we got and it's not horrible. Mm-hmm. So we'll just keep it.
Yeah. Okay, we've got a new listener. A listener writing in for the first time, and John Bernardi.
What's up, John? Thanks for writing.
Yes, thank you, John. He says, hi, Stephen M. I've been listening to every Twin Peaks podcast I can get around my ears, and yours is my favorite. It's also the first one I've written into. Great analysis, and I appreciate the benefit of the doubt you've given to season two and how you are basically having a conversation with us listeners. I've been trying to write you from the time you mentioned seeing Twin Peaks season one at a Suncoast, the exact way I heard out of nowhere there'd be a home release, but I have 2 2-year-olds at home, so it's hard to get the regular stuff down, much less put together a thoughtful note. So here I am a couple months later. I watched Twin Peaks with my parents when I was 12, and it was originally airing. I dropped off when it took a break around the holidays, which was right when Little Nicky and Dougie Milford were introduced. So I mercifully missed the James Dean Hurley movie experience my first time through. We did come back, though, for the 2-hour Monday night movie that was the final 2 episodes, and it blew my mind even more than Maddie's murder. I finally saw the missing 9 episodes on Bravo a few years later and filled in the gaps, and I've been rewatching it every couple of years since. The most missed opportunity I believe there was, besides not introducing Windham Earl sooner, is not bringing Donna into the Lodge mythology. Instead of the being turned into Ben Horn's daughter storyline, her earlier conversation with the Tremonds could have entwined her into the Lodge mythology. She meets Lodge spirits because she was wearing Laura's sunglasses, but then they let her go on her merry way without keeping tabs on her? Not consistent with the rest of the Lodge spirit interactions. Donna would have become such an important character had the writers not been spinning too many plates to notice her. But she is a Hayward sister after all, and the other girls aren't even allowed to eat at the dinner table anymore, so I guess Donna has a victory in her way.
They've effectively disappeared.
Yep. I don't want this to go on forever, so I'll talk about my take on the production of the show. When the pilot was being made, no one assumed the show would go to series. That explains the European version of the pilot being made so at least something sellable would come out from the project, because they couldn't count on the show going to series. Lynch and Frost had movies already in production as well. Wild at Heart needed to be filmed first, which is why Frost basically took over season one, except for the episode with the dream sequence. Storyville, Frost's previously planned movie, wasn't ready to shoot until about halfway through the second season, so pretty much right as Leland's death was happening, Frost needed to leave to direct the movie, and instead of picking up the reins, Lynch was too heartbroken over Laura Palmer and network meddling to steer the show. Which basically means Peyton and Ingalls, capable writer, yes, but not exactly showrunners at this point, accidentally got stuck with a hot potato that is the next part of the season. Here's a list of some hurdles Peyton and Ingalls had to deal with. Kyle MacLachlan nixed the Audrey Cooper romance that was literally the next big storyline. Joan Chen asked to leave the show. James Marshall asked to leave the show. And here's some self-inflicted damage to throw in. Peyton's on record saying he and Ingalls fell in love with the absurdism of Twin Peaks, so we're essentially shortchanging plot. So what do you do when your star shoots down the next big story arc and you need to fill some space while sending off 2 of the cast members? Make their final stories huge and noir and bigger than life, and don't forget to fill that Audrey Cooper space. And while we're at it, wouldn't it be cool if we made this bizarro pastiche where the South won the Civil War? And oh crap, there's this Windham Earl thing too. Do you know anything about chess? I still enjoy this period of Twin Peaks, especially knowing how out of their depth and essentially abandoned the staff was, because even when there was some hot garbage in and out of town, there's still a ton of campy goodness and great lines sandwiched into every episode. One last thought before I get out of here. The last scene of Twin Peaks ever to air was almost Josie in the Drawer Pool. The show was put on hiatus after that episode. Can you even imagine if the show had stopped there? After being brought back, it was put on hiatus again with only 2 more episodes left to air. So the next last ever Twin Peaks scene would have been Bob reaching through the air and standing in the grove of sycamores in our world. That ending might have actually worked okay. I'm so glad. The show has such a history of coming back from the dead, even with the DVD releases. Anyone else remember that 5-year gap between seasons 1 and 2, or the American pilot needing to be bought on eBay before the Gold Box release? And holy crap, how they actually released the missing pieces. A Twin Peaks release always seems to be a surprise. How many more times do you think the new series will kick the bucket before it starts to air? Thanks for all the work you put into this show, and I look forward to hearing your take on the rest of the episodes. Take care.
Thanks a lot, John. Appreciate it. John, were you writing from work?
Thanks, John. Yeah.
So there's a bunch of stuff to address in this letter, actually. I'll go through the little stuff first.
Okay.
Suncoast. That's where we got our original VHS copy back in, I want to say it was 2000, I think.
Yeah, and David, my brother, actually got the eBay pilot, which was imported from Japan, wasn't it?
Yes, you had to get it from Japan, or that's where they produced it, at least. Uh-huh. You could get it on eBay from whoever was selling it, but you had to, it was produced in Japan, and it had this, wind tunnel effect sound like the whole time when you were listening to it, and it was really bad in the scenes where they were in the hospital for some reason. I remember that, and it was just this real bare bones DVD, and the cover of it looked like it was taken from one of the panels of the cover of the original VHS box set. It's the blue and the black with the lines going into the forest, and then you had like a go ahead.
This is another coincidence. My brother called me today. He's moving to Japan tomorrow, and he's got a package to send me, and I know it's the autobiography tapes, Dale Cooper.
Oh, nice.
He's finally mailing. This is crazy. Anyway.
But so we remember Suncoast, and we remember eBay and getting the being able to get the pilot the only way that way. And I also wanted to talk about, he had mentioned the gold box set, and I've heard a couple of other people mention that. We don't have that set.
Yeah.
We started out with the 2000 VHS set, which was the first time it was released altogether.
Right.
And then once we
as
got
as far it, as us owning it.
Well, no, I think that was the first time it was released, because I remember ordering it and having to wait until it came out on its release date. So because you could buy it, they had the individual ones that had two episodes each on them.
Mm-hmm.
They were renting out in the stores, but it only went up to a certain episode. And this was the first time that it was released as a complete series.
Okay.
But it didn't have the pilot. And then there was we never had the gold box set, which I'm assuming is a DVD one. The first DVD that we had was one that included season one and two, right? And it had Laura Palmer on the front. It had a nice slip case, and it folded out. It was mm-hmm. multi-panel. You just kind of kept folding it out. And it had some pretty good behind-the-scenes interviews and stuff like that with a lot of the cast.
The Log Lady intros.
Log Lady intros and everything. And then we just purchased the one that's pretty much complete, Missing Pieces on Blu-ray, which is, I don't know how many more times they're going to try to repackage and redo, but this one's pretty definitive as far as this stuff goes, because, I mean, it has Fire Walk With Me with all the missing deleted scenes, which is, when we watched it, it's actually another hour and a half when you take all those scenes together. But to specifically address the questions that John asked. So, yeah, the parts with Peyton and Engels getting stuck with this hot potato and not knowing what to do with it. I've mentioned before that I feel like Mark Frost and David Lynch were the fathers of this. They were the parents. And season two is kind of like a good example of what kids will do when the parents are away. They don't have any parental guidance, and they just kind of mm-hmm. go from place to place. And I know I'm being awful patronizing by calling grown men who know their craft children, just because they're not the creators of this show. They're perfectly competent and capable of producing a good show, which we saw poke through at times. But for the most part, this is what I talked about at the beginning of the podcast, kind of having another, or I have a better understanding now, or at least I feel I do, of what Peyton and Engels were going through, because I think it would be really difficult to just to be stuck with. It'd be like working at a job and you're in the mid-level of what you're doing, possibly like a supervisor position, and then all the bosses leave, but the owner comes in and says, I need you to make this work, you know, do what you got to do.
Yeah.
And then they leave too, and then you're just kind of like, all right, it's up to us. Let's make this happen. And then you're going to have some missteps.
Yeah.
And then you've got, like you said, you had your next big story arc already planned, but your star nixes it. And then you've got two characters that you were spending a lot of screen time with at given times asking to be written off the show. So it creates conundrums, and it creates, you know, you have to, you're like heading towards a story at 50 miles an hour, and then you realize there's a dead end coming. So what do you do? So I kind of have some sympathy for that. And, I'm really glad that the very last scene of Twin Peaks was not the Josie drawer pull thing. That would have been horrible. It would have been a very unsatisfying ending. I'm glad they ended it the way they did, but I agree with John that if we had gotten the other possible last scene of Twin Peaks with Bob reaching out into our world, that would have worked as well. But I'm still glad that we got to see the final episodes.
Yeah, I'm He's talking about like the possible endings of the series as it was airing. That would have been crazy if it did end with Josie in the drawer pull and.
Also, just kind of giving a little bit of sympathy towards Peyton and Engels, because we tend to be hard on them sometimes, or at least I do. And it's good to know that they were doing the best that they could, but I still really think they dropped the ball in the chess thing from Joel's letter. I'm not gonna let go of that.
Yeah.
All right, well, thanks for writing, John. All right, next piece of feedback.
Okay, so now next up, Daniel. He says, "Hey, Em and Steve, this week the show feels more enjoyable than it has in a while, and it's pretty much all thanks to the return of Gordon Cole. Also, Cooper finally gets rid of that awful flannel and back in the classic black suit and tie. What is with that bizarre looking machine in Wheeler's suitcase? Is it some kind of steamer?" It's funny how he's talking about steamer and I brought up Aunt Beru. What is he trying to do with it? I feel like that's something you'd see in the background of a racer head. You would think the sheriff's department would be on high security alert ever since Windham Earl waltzed in and left a body in the office. It's ridiculous how they accept a mysterious bonsai tree, especially from a dead woman, and not even search it. If there was a bomb on it, Windham Earl's work would be done. Also, Earl is complaining that Cooper isn't playing fair while he literally cheats by spying on him with a microphone bug. Something else that would make Earl more menacing if we didn't get to see.
The hypocrisy.
Yeah, something else that would make Earl more menacing if we didn't get to see literally everything he does behind the scenes. That totally ruins it. I have to say, Nadine looks incredibly cute with that lollipop wearing Mike's hat. Did you think she looked cute?
I didn't really think any one way or another.
Yeah, I don't remember. I mean, it was so quick.
I remember the lollipop and I remember the hat, but I don't remember thinking she looks cute.
Yeah. This whole plot line about Ben Horn possibly being Donna's true father feels completely thrown together at the last minute just to fill time and give the character something to do in the season's final stretch. There is no way this was even considered back in season one.
Agreed.
Gordon mentions the Venus de Milo, which is the same piece of statuary often seen in the Red Room. That's right. Probably not a coincidence they chose to reference that particular piece of art.
No, not at all.
You can't help but smile watching Gordon just go for it with Shelley in such a sincere, outrageous way. His bashful attempts to flirt feel so earnest and genuine, and it's really nice to see Shelley actually get appreciated and treated with respect by a man for a change, as opposed to the way people like Leo or Bobby have treated her. Actually, Gordon and Shelley's scenes are so good and over the top that they really make Annie and Cooper's budding romance feel even more flat and wooden to me in contrast. I agree with you, and I was thinking about Shelley here and how she was dismissive about the whole Twin Peaks pageant and like, yeah, she doesn't think of herself as pretty and is like, what? Really? You haven't recognized how men react around you or something? And but because of her relationship with Leo and Bobby, it makes sense that she would be dismissive and possibly having some doubts about her beauty and things like that. And then you've got Gordon coming in and, making her feel good about herself.
Yeah. So you're
So.
saying that you're kind of trying to draw that link of correlation between abused women and a absence of a sense of self-worth that's commensurate with their good looks.
Yeah, I mean, or just
Yeah.
anybody, but yeah.
Because, I mean, she would have to kind of be blind not to be able to look in the mirror and see how good looking she is, even though people judge themselves harshly.
Yeah, everybody's
But.
their own worst critic, and it's hard to see sometimes what other people see, but I have a hard time believing that just because I do know some attractive females who know they're attractive, I think sometimes there's some false modesty that goes on there. But
You're not sensing it with her, or you
no,
are.
I don't sense false modesty with her. I think she, with the at least as far as how she plays the character, no.
Yeah. Okay.
So Daniel goes on to say, also, calm down, people. Annie has only been here for one day, and the only thing that happened so far was she made him some coffee, and already Cooper is head over heels. And Truman asks him how long he's been in love with her. Really? It feels like two people fall in love because the script is telling them to, rather than actual simmering chemistry or the organic development of a relationship. And that's what I was saying earlier. They're jumping the gun.
Yeah, they are definitely agreed 100%. And I think they're doing it because they're getting close to the end of their time and they need to push this story to where it needs to be. So they're, but I like their attempts at making it somewhat believable and making Cooper be awkward and tell a joke and things like that. So some good came of it, I suppose.
What bothers me most is how much script and screen time is now being devoted to barreling through these new love stories for Audrey and Cooper, respectively, just for the sake of giving them a love interest, when there are other far more important stories to tell right now because the season is coming to an end and it won't be picked up for a third until 25 years later. It seems to me that it would have been so much more effective if Audrey and Cooper remained ambiguously friends and aloof, with no new characters suddenly appearing to pair them off, and then have Wyndham Earle take Audrey to the lodge at the end and Cooper go after her. Seeing Cooper cackling in the mirror asking, "How's Audrey?" would have had far more impact as a cliffhanger because we have had the entire season to get to know and care about these characters. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, I felt like the hair on my arms stand up when you said that, "How's Audrey?" And then I imagine Cooper saying that in that voice. It would really have a lot more effect because how's Annie? You're not invested in that character. She's wooden to begin with. She's getting a little more loose, but she's not anybody that by the time you get to the end of season two, you're just like, gosh, I hope nothing bad happens to her. You know, I mean, she's the epitome of a disposable character. So, but Audrey, I mean, you're invested in her from the very beginning. She's one of the main four or five core characters, maybe more than that because this is Twin Peaks, but you know what I'm saying.
I never thought about it like that, but you're absolutely right about that, Daniel. So the mark on Major Briggs was clearly the three triangles in an arrangement that looked like the radioactive symbol, yet here Cooper arbitrarily turns the three triangles into diamonds before combining them with the log lady's mark in order to make the owl cave symbol. That doesn't work. Also, why hasn't anyone brought up to Cooper the existence of a place called Owl Cave before when it's been clear for a while now that something is going on with the owls? The answer, of course, is because the writers just made it up. I wondered that, too.
Well, see, this kind of hits on a lot of stuff, and we can talk about it when we get to the Ghostwood thing, too, because there's writers who are just making up stuff, and when they make up something and then they make up something else, and those two things should have a linkage, they don't always recognize that linkage should be there, so they leave it off, and then it creates a storyline inconsistency that we get to try to, you know, suss out or whatever, and it's sometimes it's a dead end. But I still do have a theory that could work.
Okay.
But we'll get to it.
So Owl Cave looks like it belongs in Indiana Jones and feels pretty out of place in this show to me.
Indiana Jones.
It's the kind of thing that would show up later in Lost to reveal some new piece of lore about the island. The woods around Twin Peaks have always felt they contain this primal, elusive, incorporeal evil which seems to be clawing at the town's collective psyche. And that's really cool and mysterious. But for the writers to fill the void of that mystery with this random cave filled with ancient petroglyphs and mechanisms feels tonally divergent and wrongheaded to me. I agree that it is tonally divergent. Yeah, I can see that.
Mm-hmm.
Especially in light of the final Lynch-directed episode and the film, where it becomes painfully clear that the supernatural and the psychological in the story are like two sides of the same coin that feed off of and reinforce each other. I do wonder, though, if any of this late season two lore will ever be given any footnotes or explanation in the new material.
That's a good question. Well, like we said in one of the previous feedbacks, you know, they were talking about how we, you know, we didn't really jive with the Owl Cave being great, but it was kind of a necessity for the way that the writers were doing things in their more pedestrian way than Lynch would do later with his superior way. So it was almost like a necessary evil, and they needed to do that to give them like a physical focal point for these things, something that they could discover, and then Wyndham Earle could come behind them and do something else with, and blah, blah, blah. But as far as the Owl Cave is concerned, why wouldn't Major Briggs have brought that up at some point? It seems like that would have been something he would have just been on immediately. So it really does feel like a late inning kind of scribble in on the script.
Yeah, because wouldn't he go out in the woods and disappear for many times?
Right. He would have crossed this Owl Cave. I mean, if Annie knows about the Owl Cave, Major Briggs is going to know about it.
Right.
You know, and as far as the symbols, I mean, he's just playing with the symbols and putting them in different formations, and it just happens to form. Yeah, there's a lot of, there's too much going on there for that to feel real. It does feel a little bit coerced.
So Daniel says, however, it is interesting that David Lynch apparently took that one symbol, the diamond with the two arches protruding from it, and incorporated it into the film as a symbol on the green ring. Or maybe that was a suggestion by Bob Engel, since he probably had some input on this episode. In either case, it's just a somewhat surprising and interesting tie into this period of the show when David Lynch didn't really seem to care much about this late season two lore like Project Blue Book, Wyndham Earle, Owl Cave, etc. So relieved and excited to hear that new Twin Peaks is officially back on now with David Lynch in the director's chair. Daniel, yeah, he gave me
Yes.
some shit on Facebook about being negative about Twin Peaks.
We're just happy it's back.
Yes. We did a happy dance in the hallway when we found out. Okay, so any other discussion with Daniel's letter did you want to go into, or are we good?
I think we're good.
Okay. All right, so Daniel said also on Facebook, I want to read this before I go into Tyler's. He says, great episode of the podcast, lots of laughs. I still say, though, that there had to have been something to the whole Ghostwood thing. I mean, the fact that the forest was named Ghostwood and made the home of this evil spiritual force. Meanwhile, on the human side of things, they make a big deal about how it keeps changing ownership and there is a fight over building over it, etc. But thanks for talking about it. It has perplexed me for a while. They'd built over it, we'd have some Amityville houses or something.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I would imagine anytime you build over burial grounds like that. Anytime you build over something you shouldn't build over, because those greedy developers need to get their units sold, and that's when you get haunted houses. Or when somebody kills a bunch of people in a house, and it's built on a, you know, burial ground.
All right, so with Daniel's thought there, we go into Tyler's letter, and he says, hello, guys. First things first, on the connectedness of the Save Ghostwood campaign in Glastonbury Globe, and Glastonbury Grove, I personally think that there's no connection. Beyond that, though, I think that even if evil didn't find a way back into Twin Peaks, it would lose the idyllic qualities of the town that the Bookhouse boys hoped to protect as well. If the sawmill deal had been made in the first season, Bob would still be in town. If Ghostwood Estates had been made, it might even run the town into the ground, assuming that the sawmill is a main employer for the residents of the town. There's a lot of variables at work, so it's hard to draw any real conclusion.
Those are all good points. But what my theory is going to actually be is what, and we can wait until you finish reading Tyler's letter if you want. So
okay.
It's not really a long theory, but I tend to agree more with what Tyler's saying about it because there is too many variables and everything. But I also think there's something to what Daniel's saying. There can't be nothing to calling it Ghostwood and not having there be some sort of significance to Ben Horn, who was trying to develop it and thereby closing off the evil. But he was ostensibly a bad character at the time. And now that he's a good character, but I'll get to that.
I think there was intentions for it that got dropped to the wayside. And I think I pretty much said that last episode. Mm-hmm. But that's what I just think there wasn't follow through, unfortunately, with it.
Just like with the chess, you know, it was a great idea. They became enamored with it. And then they decided to let it go, you know,
and they built over the idea of it. And it's in itself a metaphor for Amityville houses.
Yeah.
It's fraught with mystery and horror.
You can't bury the chest because it always comes back out.
So did you want to say, you still have more to say on that?
Yeah. I mean, I could say it now if you want.
Go ahead and say it now.
Yeah, because I keep putting it off. Okay. Let's say that the forces of evil out there, imbalance in anything could be seen as an evil or a force of ill will, right? Mm-hmm. Agreed? So
right.
If we throw off things as they normally are, you create a negativity. So Ben Horn being the bad Ben Horn, which is his truest nature, is preventing, or he's preventing the evil from coming into Twin Peaks in a way because he's going to build over it with the Ghostwood Estates, thereby blocking their egress into the Twin Peaks world. So that would seem weird that a bad character would do something that would not help other bad forces, as I think what was Daniel was trying to say. But if you look at it like this, the evil in the town is influencing Ben Horn to be good by making him not be his truest self, by making him to be almost a doppelganger of himself.
Mm-hmm.
So now he's good, but he's working inadvertently for the powers of evil because he's going to prevent the Ghostwood Estate from happening.
That's what I was trying to say.
Okay.
There was the irony there that, mm-hmm. yes, he's on the face good now, but really what he's working toward is preserving Ghostwood.
Right, exactly. So it goes hand in hand. But what I'm trying to say is the impetus for creating that irony is the evil that already exists. It's
mm-hmm.
almost like the evil is acting to preserve itself.
Right.
So that's how we get that. And so
that you bring up that he's a doppelganger, though.
That's what I'm saying. That it's once again the duality of Twin Peaks. So he's
mm-hmm.
a doppelganger of himself
mm-hmm.
because he's polarized from bad Ben to good Ben. you know, and now he's doing things because he's off balance. Like if he was on his true bad path, he would just be doing what he's supposed to be doing, and the universe is right with its balance. Now that he's thrown it off in his own small little way, he's doing something that's helping the evil things more than he should be.
Right.
So that's my little pet theory about it. So doppelganger Ben actually being good helps the bad side. There you have it.
I like it.
It's not much, but it's mine.
I kind of said the same thing.
You said the same thing, but I'm trying to give it like a reason for existing. Okay. You know what I mean? I mean,
he's being manipulated by forces.
we discussed it at length between us, you know, at that point. And, you know, we agreed that there's whatever was going on, but I was trying to give it like a genesis or a reason.
Okay.
Okay. So let's move on.
Okay. So yeah, I like it. So I agree that that's a possibility.
Daniel.
I would rather think that there's a reason for it, because I don't like to just toss things out of hand. Like, oh, it's just, you know, people not really following through, or it's just like incidentally like, named Ghostwood.
Daniel said, just bad writing, or like they made something up because, you know, like Ben Horn being Donna's dad, it's just bullshit that they just threw in there at the end. You don't want something as significant as Ghostwood to be that.
So now Tyler goes on to the episode. The Log Lady intro talks about the best treasure to find is a source of eternal happiness. She goes on to say that it may be hidden inside us all and wonders why then it would be so difficult to attain. It's one of my very favorite Log Lady intros. He's our Log Lady correspondent.
Yeah.
So, I mean, do you have any thoughts about the best treasure to find is a source of eternal happiness? She goes on to say that it may be hidden inside us all and wonders why then it would be so difficult to attain.
Well, I think that ties into, you know, when people say that you're searching for something and you keep searching and searching and then you just don't realize it's right under your nose.
Yeah.
And I think that it's...
No matter where you go, you are there.
Yeah. The key to your own happiness has always got to be yourself. If you invest it in material things or even to a certain extent other people, there's always an element of setting yourself up for disappointment. Mm-hmm. And I'm not a philosophy professor, so I don't know the ins and outs of all this. But just as general homespun wisdom, it makes a lot of sense. Whatever the biggest treasure you can find in life is whatever's going to keep giving you happiness. And for most people, that's probably not going to be a thing. It's not going to be a material possession that they can somehow procure at some point through enough work or money or what have you. It's something more than that. But so many people don't understand that simple fact.
Tyler says, do people really wear sweaters tucked into their pants like Jack does? Audrey outdresses everyone though, so I guess it doesn't really matter what he wears.
This is the early 90s, people. You got to realize, people did do that. I was probably about 16 years old when all this was happening, and in real time, and people did dress like that.
They did.
And it was very commonplace and unremarked upon. It's kind of like when you watch a show from the 70s, and you're like, wow, you know, did they really dress like, yeah, they did. You know, as hard as it is to believe now, nobody would try to pull that off. The guys in Weezer wouldn't try to pull that off, but it's what people did then.
I'm so pleased to see Gordon Cole in this episode. I hope that now that David Lynch is back on season 3, we'll also see a return of Gordon Cole, though I guess he may be retired. Banzai! Donna looks great in this episode. Do you think she feels weird about Mike being with Nadine in the hotel? I think she thinks it's hilarious.
Yeah, I have the suspicion that she's just moved past all that.
She's just not one for belly laughs.
Yeah.
That was Donna's belly laugh when she saw it.
She did. It's her belly laugh equivalent is a flick of her eyes, you know, an expression.
And a very quiet chuckle.
She's not a very big laugher.
I'm glad they didn't make Mrs. Hayward easily wooed. Has Ben Horn slept with every woman in town or tried to?
Probably tried to.
Expanding his empire while he expands his progeny?
I guess there's no such thing as child support in Twin Peaks. Mm-mm. Or do they just call that Doc Hayward?
I like that Shelley looks over to Coop and he gives the okay. Once she knows he's not a creep, she's flattered by the attention. Yeah.
See, well, Coop's got a reputation as a solid guy. So it's just like, if he says it's okay, then people are like, all right.
Well, she does also, what's going on here? Why is this guy talking to me like that? You know, she needed to have, is this okay? Can I carry on this conversation or should I just walk away?
He came in here with you. What's the story?
Yeah. Tyler says, I think Heather Graham does a lot better this episode on getting the weirdness without the stiffness this episode. It helps that Dale is also being a dork.
He is. The penguin joke is just so out of character for him, but it's a you know that it's going to be out of character for him. The writers know it's going to be out of character for him, so they have him they follow through on it.
Harry asking Dale how long he's been in love with her is yet another tie into early Twin Peaks. Coffee is being drank, and then boom, Owl Cave is mentioned. Theory proof.
The deep black cup of Joe gets the insights rolling.
In quotations, San Francisco is really cool. James is just as bad on the road, but at least it's short and sweet.
San Francisco is really cool. Like, of all the stuff you could think of to say about San Francisco, I mean, you've got a whole postcard to fill. He wrote like two sentences.
Really, it was all only two sentences?
I mean, I don't know, but he didn't give her much information. I mean, it was just enough to play a few bars from that horrible song.
Had a professor that looked a lot like Earl, this Earl disguise. I guess he did a good job.
This is probably my favorite Earl disguise as far as believability.
But it's so cliche, though.
It is, but maybe that's why it's believable, because you've seen it so many times.
It's funny that Annie mentions being out on parole, considering she's replacing a jailbird. Yeah, she is. Hank. When was the last time we saw Johnny Horn before this episode? I wonder if his role was supposed to be larger initially.
The last time we saw him was the last episode of Ben's Civil War
Yeah,
when
reenactment.
Dr. Jacoby brings him out of it and he has his Wizard of Oz moment. There's a very small little part with Ben in there. You see him, and that's it. But before that, we'd have to go back to season one, I think.
It's funny because the opening episode or opening scene of this episode, you hear that those clarinet sounds, and it sounded like Johnny to me.
Like just making his sounds in the background.
Mama. When was the last time we saw Johnny Horn before the? Okay, one of my favorite parts of this episode is Ben giving Wheeler a carrot as he would a cigar. Ben really shines here in a way that blends his season one persona and his newfound redemption arc nicely.
That's a good way to look at it. It's a charitable way to look at it. I thought it was a weird scene, and it definitely leaves Jack Wheeler kind of like, oh, what the hell's going on? I just professed my love for your daughter, and you're giving me a carrot, and you're sitting Indian style with your shoes off on the couch next to me. So.
It's a congratulatory gesture. I remember reading somewhere that Richard Beamer really didn't find his stride with the character until he adopted the cigar, because like the cigar wasn't initially a part of him,
Oh, that's cool.
and so he really felt like he could kind of get into the role when he would sit and chomp on the cigar and everything. So, and they took that away from him, but they replaced it with vegetables. So, but he still seems to be channeling Ben Horn.
Yeah, I mean, I can totally see that because it becomes a little prop and a focal point, and you
Right.
have something like, I know if I was in front of a crowd just talking, I would want something in my hand, regardless of how useful or practical it would be. I would want something in my hand. It would just make me feel better.
Owl Cave seems a little too on the nose for my taste, but I like all the character portrayals. Cooper's wondrous and strange quote is actually on my Twitter bio. Yeah, I saw that on there actually. Yeah, everybody feels like it's on the nose. I don't know why I'm not as critical.
I mean, it's a, I see where the criticism is coming from. You have this really nebulous, like mythological, metaphysical, whatever term you want to apply to it, nebulous thing like Lynch is trying to portray it. And then you have, even though Frost isn't part of this episode either, you have the Peyton and Engels duo that are doing things more of Frost's way than Lynch's way, really. And they make it a physical manifestation. They make it a place that you can go to. You know, it would be like if heaven was a place that you could just walk up to and turn a key and get into the door.
I think Daniel described it well by saying divergent tonally, but for some reason I'm willing to go with the tonal flow here. I don't, I'm okay
Sometimes it's
with
like
it.
that. Sometimes it's like
Yeah.
that. That there's been plenty of times during this rewatch of Twin Peaks for this podcast that I felt like I understand that objectively that this is not the greatest thing or even the best thing that they could be doing right now, but I'm all right with it.
But it takes the terror away from it in a way, because I did compare it to Goonies, and I think it's significant that I compared it to Goonies because that's a child's movie.
Right.
And for me to have that association with it, but then when you think about David Lynch's, way of expressing this horror, I mean, it really is horrifying, where
Yeah.
this is more.
You're right. Yeah, you're right. It is one of them expresses it in a way that it just goes back to that old thing to where whatever's left up to your imagination is always going to be scarier and more horrific than what is shown to you. What you don't see, what's in the shadows, and you have to think of becomes crazy in your mind because it could run in any direction. But if you show that thing, then it could still be very, very scary, but you're stuck with that now.
Like with David Lynch's take on what is eating away at Twin Peaks is something that sticks with you after you've watched it, and it's an unsettling
Yes,
thing.
definitely.
And I mean, you might even be still feeling it the next day after you've watched it, but where this is more of like, oh, well, that was interesting, to watch, or that was a fun ride to see that. But you're not, it's not, you don't have, it doesn't change your atmosphere in your daily life afterwards, which David Lynch has done for me many, many times.
Yeah, when you watch Twin Peaks or when you watch
His
Mulholland
movies.
Drive or even Blue Velvet to a certain extent, the next day you still have that reverberations in your
Carryover.
head and everything that you can't get away from. You just have to let them kind of slowly go off into the distance. But when you personify, not personify, but when you solidify a place like that, now it's a physical locale. You could destroy it, you could walk away from it, you could distance yourself from it. So there's ways to handle it, but where it's insidious and psychological, it's in your head and you can't get away from it. So that's why David Lynch wins in his portrayal of these things and the other ones lose. And I think to a lot of our listeners, they kind of are on the side that, it just loses its scare factor.
He ends saying, speaking a little French, Tyler. Thanks, Tyler.
Thank you, everybody, for writing. Awesome as usual.
A nice hefty feedback section.
Yeah, I think the feedback section will probably turn out to be as long as the podcast because you guys got a Steve recap, which is short and sweet.
All right, yes, so Twin Peaks is back on.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hopefully there's not going to be any more back and forths with this. Hopefully it's, they've got the go ahead. They're in pre-production mode right now, and we're going to start hearing some more casting news if they don't keep that all a secret. We'll see.
Yep.
Anything else you want to say before we sign off?
Nope.
All right, that's it for this time. I'm your host, Em.
And I'm your host, Steve.
We mean it like it is.
Like it sounds.
This was a No Ship Network podcast brought to you by Axolotl Tank Productions.